To go back to the first chapter of the Gospel of John, where we started our lesson this morning. We're talking this morning about in the beginning. That's in the beginning of the creation of God, the world. We looked at some things from Genesis. We talked about how many things that are in place today, many principles that are set in motion that affect our daily choices, actually were put into existence at the beginning. We talked about the fact that from the beginning of creation, God had a plan, He had a purpose, a redemptive purpose to save mankind. And that really is the story of the Bible. We have a lot of interesting things regarding human history in the Bible and development of civilizations and the rise and fall of nations, but all of that is really unto the fulfillment of God's plan to save mankind from their sins. And so we looked at the lesson this morning in regard to God as the Creator, as the one who, the personal being and power that has set all things into motion. And specifically in John 1, the creative agent is said to be Jesus Himself. And so we read in John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that was made. And as we read further into chapter 1, the Word is identified as Jesus. Jesus, who came into the world in the form of a man, actually was the Creator coming into the creation. But you'll notice in verse 10 it says He was in the world, and the world was made through Him, and the world did not know Him. He came to His own, and His own did not receive Him. But as many as received Him, to them He gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in His name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. When Jesus came to His own, I think in that context, it's not merely He came to His own creation, though I think that's involved. But even more specifically, Jesus came to His own people who had been prepared, ideally, by the prophets to recognize Him, to understand the significance of His being and His teaching and His intent in coming. But yet when He came and presented Himself to His own people, they didn't recognize Him. They did not appreciate who was in their midst and the significance of that life. The light had shined in the darkness, as John says there, but the darkness did not comprehend the light. So as we follow the story of the Creator in the creation through the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we come not to the beginning, which we emphasized this morning, we come to the end, in a sense. And that is the end product of what God had been doing since before the foundation of the world. Jesus comes into the world. He is incarnate. He is God in the flesh. And He demonstrates the nature of God by doing miracles that have a moral dimension to them. He didn't just go out and amaze the multitudes by levitating objects and whatnot. He came and demonstrated the character of God in the works that He did. He healed the sick. He allowed the lame to walk again. He gave sight to the blind. He fed the hungry. He demonstrated not just power, but compassionate and interested power in the souls of men. But as Jesus went ahead and did that work that the Father had sent Him to do, opposition increased against Him because men did not fully appreciate what was happening in their midst. And so at the end of His earthly phase of His existence, He comes to the point of being put on trial. At least, I suppose we could call it a trial. Everything about it seems to be false and a matter of injustice. But nonetheless, Jesus is brought to the end of His life by, at least in part, a judicial process. That being a matter of the Jewish high priests and Sanhedrin council, along with Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, procurator of Judea at that time. And even Herod, the king over the region, had something to do with proceedings. But nonetheless, at the end of those proceedings, Jesus was pronounced fit to be crucified. There's one point in those proceedings, as interesting as all of that is, and we don't have time to look at it all tonight, but there is a point in those legal proceedings where it appeared that Jesus might be set free. And from a earthly standpoint, from a carnal perspective, we might be rooting for that. You know, we watch a movie, we watch perhaps The Passion of the Christ, or we watch another depiction, or we read from the Gospels, and we see this injustice unfolding from one event to the other, and it might be that we're rooting for Jesus to be released. Of course, that would mean our demise spiritually. If we had seen in these proceedings the right thing done, justice in fact carried out, we would still be in our sins. Jesus would have lived. He would have escaped the sentence of death, and there would have been no sacrifice offered on our behalf. So the things that happened, as was said on many occasions, must be so, because it was declared by God and part of God's purpose. But still, we root for Jesus to be freed. We want the right thing to be done by Him. And it's not. But look at Matthew chapter 27 and verse 15. Here's the moment, and this is what I'd like to focus on for the rest of the sermon this evening. The moment where it appeared there might be some sliver of hope that Jesus might be set free. Matthew chapter 27, I want to read with you what is noted from a historical standpoint in verse 15. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished, and they had a notorious prisoner named Barabbas. I'll tell you, when I read that story earlier on in my life, I thought it was very peculiar. What a strange-sounding custom that once a year, one of the prisoners that the Romans had, one of the Jewish prisoners, would be released. And then you begin to look around at the world today, and you see the same thing happens. In fact, just last week, I was reading an article in the paper, and I don't remember the specific context. I believe it might have been an Israeli, maybe, held by the Palestinians. And he had been held, I think, for several months, maybe 3 months, and nothing had been heard from this fella in a long time. And then suddenly, you begin seeing him on videos that are released, and he's identifying himself and identifying some mark that would indicate that it's a current video, holding up a newspaper or something. And the comment in the paper said this. It said, you know, when you begin to see things happen like this, it's an indicator that the fella is going to be released soon. And the point of that simply is, in our own day and time, men are taken prisoner and men are released from their imprisonment as political statements. So what's happening here among the Romans and the Jews is really not so unusual. I think the situation is simply this. The Jews were obstinate and rebellious people. They were extremely difficult to rule over. This would not have been a plum position among the Roman Empire to be the procurator of Judea, because the Jews were implacable and very, very difficult to rule over. They were rebellious. They resented Roman rule, and rightfully so. But in order to try to pacify them and keep them happy, this custom arose of releasing a prisoner. And Pilate, as we're going to see through some of the things that we'll read in the course of the lesson tonight, Pilate, Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, understands that Jesus has been delivered to him without cause. And Pilate is trying to think of a way to release Jesus and do so in such a way that would take some pressure off of him from the Jewish leadership, which he knows wants Jesus crucified. And so relative to this custom of releasing a prisoner, Pilate attempts to release Jesus. And what he wants is to appeal to the people and let the voice of the people decide. He doesn't want to make this decision. He wants the people to decide that Jesus should be the one to be released. And Pilate doesn't live in a cave. I mean, he understands that Jesus is a very popular figure among the people, among the common Jews. And Jesus has just a few days before this been welcomed into Jerusalem by thronging multitudes, identifying him as the Son of David, singing praises to Jesus. Pilate knew that. Pilate's the governor. He knows what's going on. And he wants to pass the buck to the Jewish populace. If I can get them to request for Jesus to be released, I can release him and not have the heat of the Jewish leadership on me. So that's the custom. Let's take a look at the choice then that's offered to the people. Turn to Luke chapter 23. We'll be shuffling back and forth between the Gospels, looking at various details that are given to us in the different biographies of Jesus here. But Luke chapter 23. We kind of let the cat out of the bag in verse 18, but we'll read it for context. And they all cried out at once, saying, "Away with this man," that's Jesus, "and release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain insurrection made in the city and for murder." Pilate is going to stack the deck. "I want to get the people to request that Jesus be released so I can tell the Jewish leadership, hey, it wasn't me, it was them. They wanted him released." That's the choice of the people. So then what does he do? He puts forward two men in whom there should not have been a choice. First, he brings out Barabbas. And he's described as being, I think it was back in the passage in Matthew we read, a notorious prisoner. This is not just some anonymous petty thief or street crime person. You know, this is a notorious prisoner. The Jewish people know about Barabbas, and they know his history, and they know why he was taken and incarcerated. And it was for insurrection against Rome. And in the course of that insurrection, we read in another one of the Gospels, murder was committed. And it's not only Barabbas that was taken, but there are others that were taken in that insurrection. So on the one side, we have Barabbas. On the other side, we have Jesus. Jesus, whom we have already identified from the Scriptures as being the Creator. Jesus, the King of David. Or King after David, the family of David. The one who was prophesied that would come of David's descendants. We have a man who was identified as nothing more than one who went about doing good, teaching good things. He was innocent of any crime or wrongdoing. Turn with me to the Gospel of John, chapter 19. Not only was Jesus innocent of any crime, Pilate knew that he was innocent. Pilate knew that there was nothing that Jesus had done to bring him to this point and to have such accusations made against him. John 19, beginning in verse 6. "Therefore, when the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, 'Crucify him, crucify him.'" This is as Pilate brings Jesus and Barabbas out before the crowd. "Pilate said to them, 'You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him.'" You understand, don't you, that in verse 6, this is not the reaction Pilate is wanting. When he brought Barabbas and Jesus out, he was hoping the crowd would cry out for Jesus to be released. That's not what's happening. The Jews answered in verse 7, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid. I don't know how much of that fear was his own superstition. I don't know how much had to do with the dream that his wife had had about this situation the night before, which we're told about in the Gospels. But here's the point I want to make about what's going on here. There is a clear, unambiguous choice to be made. And sometimes in our society, people are defended for making the wrong choice. Because in one form or another, the argument is it was an ambiguous choice. Well, it wasn't absolutely clearly right or wrong. Well, there were some factors about doing wrong that made it sort of sound okay. there seemed to be some advantage, or there was some, it was his upbringing, it was society. Society shaped him in such a way as to make him make the choice that he made. Or he was temporarily insane, and he thought that in his demented state that this would be the right thing to do, so we ought to excuse it, or we ought to mitigate the punishment, or we ought to go lightly. We ought to understand the pain that made the man make the choice that he made. We hear all kinds of rationalizations and justifications like that in our society about wrongdoing. And of course, where a lot of people are coming from is there are no absolute rights or wrongs. There are extenuating or mitigating circumstances that can justify just about anything in the minds of some people. This is not one of those cases. This is a clear choice between a man who is guilty of murder and insurrection against the Roman government and a man who went about doing good and exercising the miraculous power of God to the betterment of mankind. And Pilate knew it. I'll tell you what, beyond that, the Jews knew it. But the life of Jesus is in Pilate's hands right here. Pilate can let him go, as he tells Jesus later, "Do you not know that I have the power to release you?" Pilate can stop these events by word. But as we read on, he doesn't. And so, the two choices are presented before the people, an unambiguous choice between light and darkness, good and evil. Turning to Luke chapter 23, let's look at verses 16 and following. Luke 23. There's a little bit more here said about the custom that we have mentioned of releasing a prisoner at this time, the Jewish Passover feast. Luke 23, beginning in verse 16. Pilate again is trying to weasel out of the situation. "I will therefore chastise him and release him." You see the irony in that, don't you? Pilate knew he was innocent. He hadn't done anything. Guilty of nothing. But I'll go ahead and beat him. I'll go ahead and chastise him if that will appease you. "For it was necessary," in verse 17, "for him to release one of them at the feast. And they all cried out at once, saying, 'Away with this man, and release to us Barabbas.'" Away with this man, and release to us Barabbas. Now, why do you suppose the crowd was crying out in unison for that outcome? What was it that took, at least I'm sure some of this crowd had been ones who had welcomed Jesus into Jerusalem a few days before, hailing him as the son of David and the king of Israel, and praising God for his appearance. And now, seemingly the mob as one is crying out for Jesus to be crucified. Look at Mark chapter 15. Mark chapter 15 and verse 11. "But the chief priests stirred up the crowd so that he should rather release Barabbas to them." You see, it wasn't just that nature was taking its course, as it were. The Jewish priests were stacking the deck. They were going through the crowd. And I don't know, I think stirred up is a loaded term here. Stirred them up how? Threatening? Daring them to cry out the name of Jesus, threatening them with excommunication, which had been done in the latter portion of Jesus' life. Anybody who stands up and says anything positive about Jesus of Nazareth will be excommunicated. So stirred up, I think there's a lot involved in that word. Stirred up the crowd. However they did it, by hook or crook, they were going through the crowd formulating the cheer, as it were. Cry out for Barabbas, do not cry out for Jesus. So back in Luke 23 again. Luke 23, beginning in verse 21. Well, back up to 20. Look at the desperation of Pilate. Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called out to them. This is after they've said in verse 18, away with this man, released to us Barabbas. Pilate is continuing to try to turn the tide and find a way, if at all possible, to release Jesus. Verse 21, but they shouted, saying, crucify him, crucify him. And when he said to them the third time, why? What evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified, and the voices of these men and of the chief priests prevailed. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested, and he released to them the one they requested, who for insurrection and murder had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Jesus to their will. Pilate crumbles. He had the authority, he had the knowledge of what was going on. He had the manpower to force an outcome. But he, like so many politicians today, is more interested in political expediency than doing the right thing. What we see in politicians today, protecting their territory and making sure they're going to get reelected and keeping the favor of the people, etc., etc., well, that's nothing new. In fact, there's an article in the paper today about how politicians are handling the oil, I guess I can call it a crisis, the fact that what is existing today is, you know, I don't want to get too political here, but the article was from the standpoint that what's happening in the price of gas is not related to oil companies, you know, jacking the price up and down. It's related to other things. But politicians like to trumpet that because it makes them sound like they're doing something against evil big business and et cetera, et cetera. There's my political statement for the day. But anyway, the point is, politicians in all ages seem to be interested in their position and maintaining that position rather than doing what is right. That's where Pilate is. That's where Pilate is. And so in Matthew chapter 27, in verse 24, when it is obvious that Pilate has lost the day, he's lost the battle, says in verse 24 of Matthew 27, when Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it. So a big political to-do, a big public to-do is made so that Pilate would appear to be innocent. He brings out a basin and washes his hands in front of the people. Well, you know, I tried to do what I could do. But you insist, so you have it your way. And so the voice of the people, incited by the priests, carries the day, and Jesus is delivered over to crucifixion. Now, the irony in this choice that is made. Turn with me to Luke 23. Let's go back and see what charge was made against Jesus when he was brought before Pilate by the Sanhedrin. Luke 23, beginning in verse 1. Then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king. So Pilate asked him, saying, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered to him and said, it is as you say. Do you see the irony here? They bring Jesus to be crucified on the basis of insurrection against Rome, an accusation of which he is innocent. But Barabbas is guilty of it. And who do they request to be released? Barabbas. What hypocrisy. What contradiction. What a show. What dishonesty. Barabbas, guilty of insurrection, is called for to be released, while Jesus, innocent of insurrection, is delivered to Pilate on that very basis. So, what does all of this mean for us? Martin calls this the so what portion of the lesson. So what? Well, I think there's a lot of things to learn from what's going on here, perhaps to apply in our own situation. I'll just make a few observations and invite you to make your own in your own reflections later. But firstly, perfect justice doesn't exist in this world. As much as we want to root for Jesus, and we want the right outcome from this sham proceeding, we want the innocent man to be released and the guilty parties to suffer the consequences. What happens to Jesus is a lesson, I think, for all of us in that this world does not satisfy the demands of perfect justice. And, of course, this becomes a reason for agnosticism or downright atheism. Well, if God is who He says He is, if He is all-powerful and He is all-good, why should I believe in Him when I see injustices taking place all around me? And we don't have time to answer that in detail. But I will say this, that along with the goodness and the power of God, there's also another element operating here and operating in our own lives, and that is human free will. Human free will. And I'll tell you what, I think at some point in life we all struggle with this. Someone recently said this to me. Their daughter was marrying someone that they did not approve of. And the mother made the statement to the effect, I just don't understand why God won't step in and prevent this from happening to spare me the grief of my daughter marrying this man. This is a person who's been a Christian for quite a long time. And I'm not saying that to demean her in any way. What I'm saying is there are times in life that come along where we're perhaps watching the train wreck about to happen. We're seeing events flow in a direction that gives us great concern, and we wish a different decision would be made. But in my conversation with her, we touched on this very point. God endows us with free will. Your daughter has free will. We can teach and train. We can beg and plead and urge, and we can help guide and engineer and do whatever we can do. And at the end of the day, God endows us with free will. And He has stood by and watched every single human being who is responsible, watched every single human being, me and you included, exercise our free will in a rebellious way toward Him. And He didn't intervene in that to prevent us from doing what we determined we were going to do. On the one hand, we say, well, what a great world it would be if God would just intervene and prevent evil from happening. Well, then we wouldn't be human beings. We wouldn't be created in His image. We would be robots, and God would simply be there pulling the strings and making us do certain things, and then you know what the outcry would be. Why doesn't God give us free will? Why does He control everything that we do? But the fact of the matter is, God, whether we like it or not, we agree with it or not, God has endowed us with free will, with power to choose and power to decide, and sometimes that power is exercised by those under the influence of darkness rather than light, and bad things result. And not only do you have the Jewish element here pushing and pushing and pushing this thing forward, but you have somebody like Pilate who is a moral coward. You see, in society, you've got some people pushing and pushing for the wrong thing to be done, and you've got other people that won't stand up to them. People in responsible positions to do that. I'm not talking about vigilantism. I'm talking about judges and policemen that will not exercise the law in such a way. My nephew, most of you probably don't know him, my nephew was visiting with us yesterday. And he is in a supervisory position in the county jail in wherever, whatever county Winder's in. I don't know, somewhere out that way east. And he was telling me about the people that they see in the jailhouse over and over and over again. And I'm not talking about petty criminals, I'm talking about felons. And they keep committing felonies, and they go before the judge, and the judge gives them probation, and they go back out and commit more felonies. He said, we see them over and over and over. See, they're not just people in this world that are determined to do wrong. They're people that are not determined to do anything against them doing wrong. And so how often do we hear in the news about a person raped or murdered or otherwise treated treacherously, and the guy has a rap sheet, you know, to the floor? It's not uncommon at all. So some people exercise their free will that God grants them with in the hope that they'll exercise it in a way that will glorify Him, but they exercise it for evil. And God does not intervene and prevent every evil thing from happening. And then, as we said, some, like Pilate, are moral cowards. And then there are people in the world that just simply root for the evil person. It seems like that there are some people that cannot do enough evil. Somebody won't stand up and be on their side. And that flabbergasts me. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what you've done. It seems like there's somebody who will stand up and advocate your cause. And that's because those people are exercising their free will in an evil way. And lest we hold the Creator to our judgment, which is what we tend to do in these kinds of matters. Well, God should have done this, and I think God would do that. And God being good and God being powerful ought to do this and ought to do that. And we begin to critique Him for how He handles the world He's created. We better be very, very careful of bringing God before our bar of judgment. But at the end of the day, here's the point in this observation, and that simply is some things are only going to be resolved in the hereafter. Now, we can say that's not fair, that ought not to be that way, that every wrong done should be adjudicated and punished at the moment, etc., etc. Well, it isn't that way. What are we going to do? It isn't that way. For whatever reason, God has not established the world so that, number one, no evil can be done, and number two, any evil perpetrator is going to be punished on the spot. That's not the way God has established the world. And we could explore lots of reasons why it may be so, but I'm not going to do that right now. Fact of the matter is, it isn't so. It just isn't that way. That's not the nature of the world we live in. We can criticize God if we want to for that, but I think we're overstepping our bounds. But we are given this assurance in the Scriptures. All men are going to be brought before the judgment seat of Christ, and they're going to give an account for what they've done in this life. And the hidden things of the heart are going to be revealed. Lest we point our fingers too quickly at the rapists and murderers and robbers, our hearts are going to be revealed in the day of judgment. What I really thought about you and what you really thought about me is going to be revealed in the day of judgment. And what I thought about God is going to be revealed in the day of judgment. And what I secretly desired to do, but for fear of being revealed to everybody as being a wrongdoer and covered up, that's going to be revealed in the day of judgment. If there were no ultimate rectification of these things, perhaps God could be said to be unjust. But that's not the case. Divine justice will be satisfied, but not always in this life. And so, you know, from an earthly standpoint, Barabbas won. And the Jews won. And Pilate won. I don't know what they won. But in that moment of time, in that power struggle, in that political environment, the bad guys won. But look what God did with it. Look what God did with it. Secondly, as we see in this situation, we are often influenced by others to do what is wrong. And it's so easy in a you know, a setting like this or a Bible class or in, with our families and everything is in place and we're sort of steeped in a spiritual environment, it's easy to say what we would or wouldn't do. But I'm going to tell you what temptation is. It's placing us in an environment, in a situation that we probably weren't expecting. And the dynamics of that bring certain things to bear upon our souls that make, for whatever reason, the wrong seem attractive. Temptation sometimes plays on our fear. It may be that I'm persuaded to do what is wrong simply because I fear the circumstances. Let me tell you, you put yourself in the crowd and you see this scene, it's hard to see, you see this scene with Pilate standing up there and Jesus and Barabbas and the priests are going through the crowd, perhaps threatening, doing whatever it is that they're doing to incite the crowd to cry out for Barabbas. And everybody around you is crying out for Barabbas. Do you think you would have found it easy to cry out for Jesus in the middle of that crowd? And the minute your little feeble, "Release Jesus," came out and somebody turned around and cold-cocked you, how easy would it be to get up off the ground and the second time cry out for Jesus to be released? I mean, sometimes we do what is wrong because we're just scared, or at least we fail to stand up and do what's right because we're afraid. Sometimes it's just our desires. Satan knows how to play on our desires. He knows how to formulate an environment where those desires are inflamed. And we do what we good and well know to be wrong. But because of the nature of temptation, because temptation is not just the suggestion of an act of a moment in time, it's usually a whole host of things that come together, the perfect storm, as it were. And we find ourselves caught out. I wasn't ready for that. I didn't know it was going to feel that way. I didn't know I was going to react that way. I didn't know what that pressure would do to me. And this really happens when our convictions are weak. When we imagine ourselves in a tempting situation, we imagine ourselves strong. When the reality comes, it might be that that reality has found us in a moment of weakness. And we're often influenced by other people to do what's wrong. And so we need to beware what everyone is doing. Sometimes there's a sense of safety in that. All the scientists believe in this. All the theologians believe in this. All the churches practice this. All the Nazis think Jews ought to be exterminated. Be careful when we begin reasoning about right and wrong based on what everybody thinks. What the opinion polls show. The drift that we think, you know, everybody else is leaning toward, and we begin to think, how can so many people be wrong? I'm going to tell you, a lot of people are wrong a lot of the time about a lot of things. We see various examples in the daily news and examples in the scriptures that oftentimes the masses are guided by emotion, not by reason. Acts 19, for an example, in Ephesus. The masses are often driven by emotion. That's why politicians play to emotions. That's why sometimes the logical argument loses out to the emotional manipulation of whoever, politicians, friends, family members that tend to take us in the wrong direction. Then finally, think about this point. It's easy to look back at this situation and think what I would or wouldn't have done had I been Pilate, had I been in the crowd, had I been Peter or John. Remember what Jesus has said about his own disciples the night before all of this transpired was, "You're going to flee from me. You're going to leave me alone." Of course, see, they couldn't imagine temptation. When they imagined themselves in temptation, they imagined themselves strong. When the moment came, they weren't. But we put ourselves back in that place and we might think, well, I would have done that. I don't know why somebody didn't stand up for Jesus. I don't know why Pilate just didn't make that decision and free him. I don't know why things happen that way. And then it might be that in some way, shape, or form in our own lives today, we're making the same decision in principle. We're making the same decision for Barabbas against Jesus. The choices that we make today indicate what choice we probably would have made then. In our lives today, when we have a choice to make between doing what Jesus would advocate us doing, teach us doing, what He set the example for us doing, when we have a choice between Jesus and the world, and we choose the world for whatever reason, under whatever duress, under whatever pressure, but, you know, we do find ourselves in these dilemmas every day. I can choose to do what Jesus would have me do. I can choose to defend the truth that He stands for, the morality that He stands for, or I can go the way of the world. And when we choose the world, we're in essence making the same decision for Barabbas that was made by the people in that day. What Jesus says is there is no neutral position when it comes to Him. And I think a lot of people comfort themselves. Well, I don't really have a hostile feeling toward Jesus. I think He was a pretty good guy, and I think He was a good teacher, and His influence has been mainly, perhaps, good for society since. So, you know, I'm not totally against Jesus, but here's what Jesus said in Matthew 12 and verse 30. He who is not with me is against me. Jesus does not leave us that neutral middle ground. We're going to make choices every day that are either for Jesus or against Jesus. And when we make those choices for the world, or we make those choices for ourselves, we're essentially making the choice for Barabbas. We're really not doing anything different in principle. When we choose against the authority and the will and the teaching and the example of Jesus, when we choose against that, we're not doing anything different in principle than what these people did in choosing Barabbas to be released and Jesus to be crucified. And so, what choice are you making consciously in your life or unconsciously? What determines the fabric of your life day by day? Where is your moral compass centered? The one thing that the trial of Jesus really comes down to, it's not just about those people in that day and time. It really puts us all to the test. What do we really believe about Jesus? And what are we choosing day by day regarding that belief about Him? And we can read historically and see a miscarriage of justice and the wrong thing was decided. Perhaps we come to that conclusion. I think we should, based on the evidence of the case. But are we in our own personal and practical lives doing any better? Are we doing any better in standing up for Jesus and defending Him and acknowledging the legitimacy of who He is and what He has taught us to be? Are we doing any better than Pilate? Any better than the Jews? Any better than the crowds that called for Barabbas? I hope these are things that we'll think about during the coming week as we go out day by day and we have opportunities to make decisions. And those decisions are going to reflect where Jesus stands in our mind and in our heart. If you would desire to be a Christian this evening, having thought, contemplated, come to an understanding of who Jesus is, but all that's been lacking perhaps till this moment in time is the commitment to become a child of God, then we want to offer you the opportunity. We want to encourage you to do that. To not let another moment go by, because in the day of judgment, we will be held to account for all things, all decisions, all words, and our reaction to Jesus. Is there any way we can help you while we're standing and singing?